WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Back in the 60s, the saying was the revolution will not be televised. Well, our author today says the revolution will be digitized. Our guest is going to be an Anglo-American journalist, Heather Brook, talking about her book, The Revolution Will Be Digitized, Dispatches from the Information War, talking about Wikipedia, threats to freedom of speech, to privacy, all sorts of nefarious activities going on by both the public and private sector. It should be a terrific show. I hope you'll join us. But before we go to our guests, let's go to NPR News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. The CEO of JPMorgan Chase says he was dead wrong when he dismissed concerns about the bank's trading. Speaking on NBC's Meet the Press, Jamie Dimon says he played down the concerns in April.
We know we were sloppy. We know we were stupid. We know there was bad judgment. We don't know if any of that's true yet.
On Thursday, the bank disclosed $2 billion in trading losses over the past 6 weeks. Investors shaved almost 10% off JPMorgan's stock price the next day. Greece seems to be headed for a repeat election after top party leaders met with the country's president and for the last time failed to agree on forming a coalition government. John Zeropoulos has more from Athens.
The radical left Syriza has for the last time scuppered any hopes that it might join more moderate parties in a coalition. Syriza denounces Greece's bailout and austerity program as disharmonious with the popular will. It came in a surprise second in last Sunday's election with 17% of the vote. Greece's creditors say there is no alternative way for Greece to remain within the eurozone. Syriza's refusal to cooperate means that the democratic left also withdraws, and that leaves only the socialists and conservatives who lack the seats to govern. They wanted a two-year administration that would keep the euro and renegotiate rather than renounce the tough austerity package. Greece is now likely to hold a repeat election next month, and that could jeopardize its membership in the euro. For NPR News, I'm John Saropoulos in Athens.
China, Japan, and South Korea are warning North Korea that they will not tolerate another nuclear test. As NPR's Louisa Lim reports, the warning came at a trilateral summit in Beijing.
South Korea's President Lee Myung-bak says they will not accept any more provocations from North Korea. He is not saying what will happen if Pyongyang pushes ahead with its threatened nuclear test. China's Premier Wen Jiabao says a pressing task is to prevent tensions on the Korean Peninsula from escalating. China, Japan and South Korea are also agreeing to begin talks about a free trade agreement. China's Xinhua news agency argues this could lift the three countries' economies. But reaching a pact, which has been on the table for a decade, will not be easy. The countries have, however, agreed to an investment agreement as a first step towards deepening economic ties. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Beijing.
Activists in Spain, angered by grim economic prospects and low unemployment rates, are protesting in the nation's largest cities. The demonstrations began Saturday to mark the one-year anniversary of a spontaneous movement that prompted similar movements around the world. 72,000 people marched against the government's tough austerity measures in Madrid, Barcelona, and six other large cities, but protesters claim the turnout was much higher. The epicenter of the protest is in the capital of Madrid. This is NPR News. California's budget deficit is expected to swell to nearly $7 billion more than expected due to weak tax revenues and slow progress in cutting budgets. Governor Jerry Brown says the projected shortfall for the fiscal year is much higher than previously thought.
The result is that we're now facing a $16 billion hole, not the $9 billion we thought in January.
Brown says this means that California's legislators will have to go much further and make cuts far greater than expected. He also stressed that a hole of this magnitude can't be fixed with cuts alone without doing severe damage to schools. The New York Rangers 2-1 win over the Washington Capitals in the National Hockey League playoffs last night is delighting fans in New York and New Jersey. From member station WNYC, Mark Garber has more on their reaction.
The stage is set for a Trans-Hudson River showdown pitting the Rangers against their arch-rival New Jersey Devils in the Eastern Conference Finals. The teams famously battled through seven games in 1994, with the Rangers winning in overtime and advancing to take the Stanley Cup. And Devils fans want redemption. Games 1 and 2 of the finals will be held at Madison Square Garden, and games 3 and 4 across the Hudson in Newark at the Prudential Center. The action begins Monday night at 8. For NPR News, I'm Mark Garber in New York.
The latest numbers show the number of New York Police Department street stops skyrocketed to more than 200,000 stops during the first 3 months of 2012. That's up from just over 183,000 stops during the same quarter last year. The policy allows police to stop a person based on reasonable suspicion. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Valvoline, maker of Next Gen Motor Oil. Engine protection with oil made from 50% recycled stock. Learn more at Valvoline.com.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live May 13th, 2012, here in WILL AM 580. Based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today is the author of a book I've had the privilege of just finishing. I was at a conference in London 4 or 5 weeks ago, and I asked someone who was selling books at the conference, you know, what are people reading? What's just come out? And they handed me a copy of the book, The Revolution Will Be Digitized. I said, this is the book a lot of people are talking about. And I bought a copy. I read it on the plane back across the ocean and devoured it, in fact. Enjoyed it so much. And since then, we've been trying to get the author of the book, Heather Brook, to join us as our guest. And we're fortunate enough today to have Heather Brook with us. Heather Brook is an American journalist, Anglo-American journalist, I should say, and Freedom of Information campaigner. She's lived in the 1990s in the UK. She's written several books, including Your Right to Know, The Silent State, and Now the Revolution Will Be Digitized, which is available in the U.S. in audio form. And she's a visiting professor at City University's Department of Journalism. Heather Brook, welcome to Media Matters.
Hi, welcome.
Well, thank you so much for taking time out of your, I guess, evening in London or in England to join us here.
Yes, yes.
And
it's
let me first.
Sunny here today. Change.
Yeah. I'm glad to hear that. First of all, what is the information war that's in the subtitle of your book?
Well, what that is, it's the time that we're in at the moment, and I guess you could describe it as the battle for the free internet, the right of citizens to communicate with each other without state interference or state surveillance, and the internet has kind of come by stealth into this amazingly powerful position in society where people can suddenly communicate instantaneously across the globe. And this has sort of caught a lot of people in governments, not just authoritarian governments, but also in democratic governments, by surprise. And I think what we're seeing now is that after the Arab Spring and different sort of freedom movements, particularly freedom of speech movements, that a lot of governments, again, not just authoritarian, but also democratic governments, are very well attuned to what the internet is about in terms of decentralizing power down to people. And so I think what the information war is about is this attempt by citizens to keep hold of this amazing technology, which allows us to communicate and link together, but also trying to stop governments increasingly feeling that because this is such an important medium, they need to control it. And that's what we see from, it's not just China anymore or Saudi Arabia who are trying to be able to survey their entire internet. It's also, you know, our own democratic countries like Britain, like America, like Europe. They're now starting to look at China as a kind of role model on how the state needs to start surveying all of its citizens.
Now, in addition to the state, in the book, you talk about the crucial role that the private sector, and specifically in the case of the internet, a handful of semi-monopolists, if not flat-out monopolists, like Google and Facebook and Microsoft play. Are they basically a progressive force to stand up to tyrannical states, or do they have a more dubious role?
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, they're businesses, so their primary motivation is to make a profit. And I think in many cases, you can see with the different laws that have tried to go through in America that Google and sometimes Facebook, but less so Twitter, have stood up against these kind of nefarious internet surveillance pieces of legislation. But again, at the end of the day, they just want an easy life. They just want to be able to do their business. And if the government is making it difficult enough for them to carry out that business, then it moves into their interest to just say, okay, well, look, if you're going to make it you know, very difficult for us to operate, then we will be willing to sacrifice certain things. We will allow you to subpoena, well, not just subpoena our user data, but we will give you a portal directly into our user databases that you can start harvesting data in real time. And that's really the problem, is that we can't rely on the companies to represent, principles of justice, principles of freedom of speech, because they have their own monetary interests to look after.
Our guest today on Media Matters, who you've just been listening to, is Heather Brook, the author of the new book, The Revolution Will Be Digitized, Dispatches from the Information War. It is available in audio form presently in the United States. Hopefully, for the sake of American readers, it will be available in print soon. I've had the privilege of reading the print edition, and it is well worth the time. If you'd like to call in with questions or comments for Heather Brook, the telephone number here at WILL is 217-333-9455. The toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Heather Brook, one of the really interesting parts of the book to me was you had long discussions of the WikiLeaks scandal, and you were in a scandal, crisis, whatever you want to call it,
yeah.
Brouhaha. You were involved with it really before it really hit the front pages, so to speak. And you were dealing with Julian Assange long before he became a household name. And I wonder if you could just, from your perspective, I don't know what you know, what Americans saw of WikiLeaks, if you just read our news media or watch television reports. But, you know, just to generally start by saying, you know, what do you think the important points are about WikiLeaks that maybe haven't gotten quite through to people yet?
Well, I think there's a lot of mythology around WikiLeaks. And I'll be the first to admit that I, like most journalists, was kind of drawn in by that. This sort of idea of a kind of pirate-like data haven where you could suddenly publish information, particularly in Britain, where Britain doesn't have a First Amendment. I found this really strange when I first moved here from America. We kind of imagined that England is this great bastion of free speech, and in some cases it is, but in fact, we have the terrible libel law here. We have 300 laws which prohibit publication in different formats. And so when you saw something like WikiLeaks, which was by its nature this kind of jurisdictionless no man's land where you could publish the unpublishable, it was very intriguing. And there was a lot. There was a few journalists, particularly in Britain, that were very excited about it because they had a lot of material which they couldn't publish in Britain because of privacy laws, because of our libel law, and they were interested in harvesting what was already on WikiLeaks, but also putting stuff on there themselves. The fallout of WikiLeaks is kind of all the idealism that I think a lot of people had in this concept. I think it was a lesson in politics, really, which is that any organization has to be based on some fundamental principles. And if you're going to base an organization on principles about freedom of expression and transparency and accountability, then you actually have to abide by those principles yourself, particularly if you're setting yourself up as the leader of this organization or movement. And what the story I tell in the book is really what that there's a kind of global story about politics, and politics around the internet, but also I tell this quite sort of microcosm story about what was actually happening inside of WikiLeaks itself, where you had all these very high-minded ideals, which effectively got captured by one person, which was Julian Assange, and it all just became this kind of cult of personality that was sort of roped in to maximize his kind of profile, and the values that it originally started at all became sort of corrupted by this, which is a story that anybody who's covered politics will not find, you know, it's not an unusual thing that happens in political campaigns.
Is it fair to say, Heather Brooke, that your assessment of Assange when you first got to meet him and spend time with him was somewhat more favorable than it would eventually become?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's how most people kind of, you know, I think this is the danger when we have very personalized politics, is that this movement, I guess, around transparency and accountability is bigger than one person. And I think the problem was that when you just put everything onto one person, it's too much. You know, they can never live up to those expectations. I guess it's the same way when people looked to Obama to be this kind of, you know, savior of America. I mean, that's just one person cannot do that. You've got to have an actual system in place, procedures in place, that, and for me, that system is the rule of law. You know, that's the point of our democracy. It's based on a rule of law. And eventually, I think the problem when you base things on personality, whether it's one president or Julian Assange running WikiLeaks, is that all human beings are fallible. And so if you just rely on one person, it will fall apart. And indeed, that's how I saw the sort of fallout of WikiLeaks, is that as long as it was dependent on one person, that campaign would not fulfill its potential, which I don't think it has.
One of the things that was striking in the book, Heather Brooke, is that the U.S. government was able to put pressure on a handful of companies that sort of have bottlenecks at certain key points in internet commerce to sort of evict or eliminate WikiLeaks from involvement, I think, on Amazon and PayPal, for example.
Yeah.
And that basically could make them a non-entity online, at least in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, this is a really problematic thing. I mean, as much as I don't like Julian Assange personally, and I think maybe quite a few people don't, what did happen, I thought, was very much a tragedy, really, because, part of I guess, what I do in Britain is I very much remember the kind of American ideals about freedom of speech and due process and the right of a citizen to go about their business without interference of the state. And if the state wants to do something to you, it has to have probable cause and all this business. So what happened when WikiLeaks started publishing some of those diplomatic cables, and they were only a repeat of actually what we'd been publishing in the Guardian newspaper and in the New York Times already. But the fact that a government could start to put pressure on commercial entities to decide who could and could not be a customer, and which telling with banks or financial institutions who could and could not receive payments. That's entirely subjective. You know, there was no charge filed, there was no criminality that was being alleged or proven, and yet we could see that the American government had the power to do that, and indeed it still does. So I think this is definitely the part of the information war that I talk about, is that increasingly you see the American government extending its jurisdiction around the world and starting to take down websites that it has decided it doesn't like. So, you know, we have the takedown of Mega Upload in New Zealand. We have gambling sites from all around the world taken down just because they end in a .com address. And I think that's something we should worry about, that we're basically kind of extending American law. But who do these people...
Well, it's not even really law to some extent if there's no rule of law.
Well, I mean, this is what's... I talk quite a lot about this in the book, about this strange way now, because information is can flow across borders. There are no borders on the internet, really, and you know we have this global connectivity of information. So what is the law? What is the law? Because information is not contained anymore in Britain, in America, in Saudi Arabia. You know, it's moving across, it's transnational, and so what states are trying to do is either contain the internet, have sovereignty of the internet over their specific space. So that's what China and Russia and some other countries are making representations to the United Nations to re-engineer the entire internet structure and give each nation sovereignty over its own internet. I mean, and this is going to change forever the whole sort of mechanics of what the internet is and how it's grown up, this sort of freedom of movement of information. Or you get things where one country like America basically is trying to extend its jurisdiction around the world, and mostly it's doing that through copyright and through the laws that it wants to sort of get tough on about gambling sites and things like this.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Heather Brook, you've just been listening to. She is a journalist based in England and author of the new book, The Revolution Will Be Digitized, Dispatches from the Information War, just published in the UK, available in audio version in the United States. If you have questions or comments for Heather Brook, the number again, 217-333-9455. Our toll-free line, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to our toll-free line right now, line 4, Palo Verdes. You're on the air with Heather Brook.
Yes, hello. I was wondering to what extent the book covered what might be called non-individual surveillance, because I work for a large telecommunications firm, and the big thing this year is what's called big data, which is has a lot of things involved in it, but one of the things that we're looking at a lot is the attempt to monetize the gigantic amounts of information we have about large numbers of people. And so, for example, you can say how many women in this particular income bracket pass by this street corner at a given time of the afternoon. And that's relatively innocuous, but I'm wondering if you explored all the implications of this sort of work, if it gets in the hands of the government or unscrupulous private sources.
Yeah, thank you very much, caller. Heather Brook?
Yeah, I do. I do, in fact, have a whole chapter about that. I call it data dealing or data broking. And it is, it's this commodity, it's this new marketplace, which has been, well, it's not new, but I think that the scope of it is new. This and this is a market where the commodity that is for sale is our personal information. And you have all different people who are harvesting information. It's private companies, but it's also governments. And there's this whole trade that goes on about buying up different databases and then amalgamating them. And then where the data is missing is coming up with algorithms to kind of predict future behavior of people. So it's sort of like when we look at Amazon and, you know, it's sort of rhythm of books we've bought in the past and predicting what we will like in the future. But one of the most interesting interviews I did in the book was with a guy called Brian Alsis, who works at the American Civil Liberties Union in Seattle. But before that, he had worked as a kind of data guru on the Obama campaign. And he sort of explained to me the whole way that political campaigns increasingly buy up these giant databases with the intent, you know, with the desire of figuring out who is their voter, or who's a swing voter, or who can they sort of predict might be amenable to voting in the future. And he showed me this giant, it's called a data dictionary, and it was huge. It was like 646 pages with 10,000 data points, which are all different little pieces of data that you could request from this company. And, I mean, that in itself, I think, is quite shocking if you didn't know that market went on. But I think what's more disturbing is when governments start to get hold of all that information, which particularly in America they are. We've got the National Security Agency, who is sort of has kind of brought back this old Total Information Awareness Project, which was getting going in the 90s with Jonathan Poindexter, and it was sort of killed by Congress. But what we find out is that, in fact, it is actually still ongoing. And the worrying thing is that these algorithms that are used to kind of predict future behavior, in the hands of the government, they can be used to predict, well, who could be a terrorist or who could become a criminal? And shall we put these people on watch lists? Shall we detain them at borders when they come through? Shall we put a GPS tracking device on their car? And all these decisions are being made on subjective data, and we don't have any due process. We don't have any way to either know which lists we're on, and also how can we sort of test the robustness of who is on these lists and what were the criteria for putting them on there. So I think that's one of the particularly dangerous things about the digitization of information.
You know, after reading your book, Heather Brook, I read a lot of other stuff related to it for a project I'm working on. And I was struck by what you just said, that the private sector in this country has developed an enormous market in digital data, which it mixes with non-digital data to the extent there is such a thing anymore, and has this wealth of information. And also I was struck by the fact that companies like Google and Facebook, you know, basically everything we do associated with them, they have. I mean, it's their private property.
I'm on all those things, but I certainly don't look at them in the benign way that I used to after writing that book. I mean, I know that all that information is kept, and not that I don't think, you know, we're not paranoid or anything, but the fact is that you just don't know where that information will go.
Well, it seems from looking at firms like Google and Facebook, I mean, they're not out necessarily to turn over information to the CIA or the NSA, or they may, or they probably do. But, you know, their motivation for doing it is for commercial reasons, to have data so they can sell stuff to people. And to the extent that's just the case, what does that do to the notion of the Internet you start the book with, which is sort of this revolutionary commonwealth that empowers people to really run their own lives?
Yeah, well, I think that's very much always been the paradox of technology, is that it can offer this great potential for humanity, but also it can offer this terrible sort of dystopian future for us. And the same is true of digitization and the Internet, that it offers us great promise of a kind of globally knit together human species where, you know, suddenly we're all in this together and we can all sort of see people in, Tahrir Square. They suddenly become very human to us and we're sort of involved in all these different movements around the world. We can see the tsunami happening in Japan and feel a kind of, you know, the human connection there. But also, that same technology can be turned on its head, and the state and the intelligence services could start using it as a means, this sort of, as I say in the book, this giant panopticon, this giant spy machine where it can, where we're all under surveillance, you know, the entire time we're on the Internet, everything we do. And, you know, especially in Britain, I don't know if people say this as much in America, but this whole idea that if you've nothing to fear, you've nothing to hide.
No, we have that too, don't worry.
Okay. I mean, it really irritates me when people say that, because I think, well, you know, I don't invite cameras into my house. It's not because I'm ashamed of what I do, and I just want some privacy. I want to be left alone. I don't want to be under surveillance all the time. I find it oppressive. And also, it's really about power. I think that's what I think the most has changed since I've left America, actually, because I left America in 97, and I came to Britain, and it was kind of the rise of these CCTV cameras in Britain, and I was so shocked by the way, like, British people just kind of sheep-like, they just accepted this state surveillance over them. But increasingly now, you know, I go back to America and I see the same acceptance of this surveillance. And even when I went through the airport, and it was, I guess for me, it's just this assumption. It used to be that a government official would have to justify to you, the private citizen, why they were interfering with you. And to me, that's a really key point of a democratic society. But increasingly now, the onus has switched, and the official can just harass you for whatever reason they want. And the onus has now been put on the citizen to kind of justify themselves as either being innocent, or if you want to film, you know, if you go out and take some pictures on a public street, you know, suddenly the police can start harassing you and say, what are you doing? You know, justify yourself. Show me your papers. And to me, that's the really upsetting thing about democratic societies is that the whole point of our societies is about power, and it's about who has power. Is it the government or is it the individual citizen? And what was great, the most revolutionary thing about America was the point that the power was with the citizen, not with the state. And I think what's upset me so much is to see that shift over the last decade.
Our guest, Heather Brook, who you've just been listening to, she's the author of the new book, The Revolution Will Be Digitized, Dispatches from the Information, more available in audio form presently in the United States. It's published in the UK, and we hope it'll be available in print soon in the US. What are the plans for that, Heather?
I hope it will, too. Yes, well, I'm looking for a publisher in America.
So any publishers listening, be sure to contact Heather Brook.
Yes, do get in touch. Because, the book was kind of a strange thing. I sold it in Britain and different countries abroad first. And when I originally pitched it to American publishers, they'd never heard of, WikiLeaks, and they didn't know what it was. So they passed on it. And then WikiLeaks became such a giant story. But then they spent quite a lot of money on these very instant books, and also they spent a lot of money on the Julian Assange autobiography, which never came to pass. And so by the time my book was out, I think those people who had had the initial interest had sort of become disillusioned with the whole WikiLeaks thing. But my, as I say, this book is not about one person or one organization. It's about this entire movement about transparency and accountability.
And the number here at Media Matters, 217-333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Of course, we're coming to you live today on WILL AM 580. I don't know how much time, Heather Brook, you've had to return to the United States in the last 5 or 10 years. And I know in the book you refer to a couple of trips you've made here.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, if, now that you've been in Britain, how, in your view, British journalism, the state of the British news media, compares to the state of the American news media today? What comparisons you'd make?
Wow, it's very different, very different. I think more exciting here, but not always for good reasons. it's certainly more competitive. That's the main thing. It's very competitive, and it's also ethically more dubious. I don't know how to describe. I think, we've heard you've heard about the phone hacking.
I was going to ask you about
situation.
That. So if you want to go to that now, please do.
Yeah, but it's odd because. Part of the reason I do what I do in Britain, I sort of campaign around transparency and freedom of information, is because when I first moved here from America, I discovered that all of the sources of information that journalists use in America, predominantly public records, so whether they're crime reports or arrest jail bookings or restaurant inspections or government budgets, all these things in Britain were off limits. They were not available to the public, and there was they only had their first Freedom of Information Act in Britain came into force in 2005. So, my first book was about using this Freedom of Information Act, and it was called Your Right to Know, and it was sort of trying to teach people here in Britain how they could make use of that law and start holding governments to their government to account. But I don't know. I feel like there's a link between the way the sort of sensational press in Britain and the fact that you can't get information in a statutory way. So the only way you get information in Britain really is through connections. It's through knowing people, and the danger then is that the information is never coming clean. I mean, you always get it on a trade basis. It's a quid pro quo, and I think that really corrupts the integrity of both the journalist and the journalism they do, because they in some way they have to do a favor to get that information, and the favor is usually spinning it one way or the other to benefit the person that gave it to them in the first place. And if they're critical, then their information flow is stopped dead, and they don't get any more stories. The big investigation I did in Britain was around MP, or parliamentary expenses. And I can guarantee that nobody in Parliament could have done that investigation, because the minute they started looking into politicians' expense claims, they wouldn't have been able to write another story in Parliament. So it really had to be done by an outsider, and you had to do it using the law so that you could get the information legitimately and nobody would have anything would have any hold over you.
In that story, which was a huge scandal in Britain, I don't know, unfortunately, I don't think it really got over to America very much. Familiarity.
I think it did a bit. I mean, stuff about the moat. Did you hear the MPs claiming for cleaning their moats and one bought a duck house? But that was the kind of trivial things. But several of them ended up going to prison for fraud. And there was quite a lot of senior politicians who had to resign, including the House. The Speaker of the House had to resign over it.
But let's talk about the Murdoch scandal, if we could, the hacking scandal, because that has gotten more attention in the United States, if only because Rupert Murdoch is also a major media owner in North America.
Yeah. I think this is the thing. It was this because you have a system here where information is gathered not through legitimate ways. The only way you can get it is really through people you know, through connections. And so what you get is a kind of cartel. It's a collusion between the powers that be. And that's really what the phone hacking scandal illustrates so clearly, is this collusion between people, elites within News International, the police, and politicians. And you see this kind of nexus of power where they are all protecting their own interests. So the executives at News International, they're not representing the man on the street. They're actually representing a corporate interest that they have. And they use the newspapers to lobby politicians to further that commercial ambition. And that was the impetus around the Be Sky B, which was a satellite station that Rupert Murdoch was wanting to buy a majority shareholding of. And so that's why I want to see stronger freedom of information laws, because what it does is it starts to break up that cartel. The police had such power in this scandal because they alone hold so much personal data that a reporter needs. And so what you have is that you've got reporters going out with police, sometimes just social visits, but sometimes outright bribery to get information. And then it becomes very sort of like cozy little cartel, and I'll do a favor for you if you do something for me. And then the politicians are involved, and that's exactly what we saw with the phone hacking.
Heather Brook, one of the discussions in your book I thought was very interesting was how, although WikiLeaks made an enormous amount of material, government documents available, it required journalists to actually sift through them, assess them, make sense of them, and translate and report on their importance to readers and citizens in whatever country they were in. And one of the real problems in the United States has been that for commercial reasons, there's simply far fewer working journalists today per capita than there were a decade ago. And by most counts, we're about half the resources per capita going to journalism today than there were, say, 20, 25 years ago. So there's just not the bodies on the ground to do it. Is this a problem elsewhere, like in Britain? And if so, how are those countries dealing with it?
It's a huge problem in Britain. I mean, we have just like thousands of local newspapers have closed. And we've got whole sections of civic society that nobody knows about anymore. Like, they're black holes. Most courts now aren't covered by reporters. Most local governments aren't covered by reporters. And so you've got these whole sort of civic institutions making really important decisions with taxpayer money, and the public don't know what's going on, and there's no real public oversight anymore.
Is there any, from your look at this and your research, do you see any solutions on the horizon, or is this just we're just going to be a sort of in a newsless world?
Well, in one of the chapters in the book, I go to Norway, and I am at this journalism festival in Norway, and I'm talking about the way they do journalism in a lot of Scandinavian countries, actually, and that's all through state sponsorship. So Discovery News ever gets money from the government, and they also that also pays for a state broadcaster. Well, I mean, I think most people in sort of the capitalist West aren't really into the state subsidy of the media, and I don't really take an issue in my book on whether it's right or wrong. But what I do say is that we actually already do give subsidies to the state around media, and I don't know if I can find it at this short notice, but I give a figure about the amount of money that the Department of Defense spends on media management.
Oh, yeah, it's several billion dollars.
Yeah, and it's absolutely, it is several billion. And, you know, so don't let's make the mistake of thinking that we don't already spend taxpayer money subsidizing media. We do, but it's propaganda. We're not spending that money on objective media. We're spending it on a slanted media. And so if we are going to spend that money, I would prefer to see it go direct to an independent newspaper or radio station or TV station rather than the public relations arm of the Department of Defense.
You're in Britain where you have the BBC, which is considerably different than our NPR, which we're on presently, or our PBS, the television side of the equation.
Yeah.
How would you compare the two services, the BBC to the American public broadcasters?
Well, I think the BBC certainly has more resources because it has, it demands this TV license, which is a tax, a direct tax, and so it has a very big budget, and because of that, it can afford to have correspondents in bureaus all around the world. Although, because of our austerity measures, that's being cut as well. But I think that's important. Somebody has to pay. I think this is the transition in the digital age, is that people have this expectation that information is free because of the internet. News is not free. It is expensive. It's expensive because it takes time. It's expensive because there's legal risk. It's expensive because if you're doing a good job, you're going to make people uncomfortable, angry. They might decide to sue you, and you have to be strong enough and have enough resources to be able to take that. So it is expensive, and I'm not sure that the public are aware of the cost of that. And I actually think a lot of media do themselves a disservice because they give it away for free. They don't value what they do themselves. What do you think? I just feel like so many journalists, they don't actually value what they do, and they don't. They feel uncomfortable saying, you know what? Look, I've had to double, triple check this thing that a politician said to me, and I found out it's not true. That costs money, and I don't want to give it away for free. I want people to value it and pay for it.
Our guest today, Heather Brook, author of the new book, The Revolution Will Be Digitized, Dispatches from the Information War, available in audio in the United States, hopefully in print very soon. It is available in print if you're fortunate enough to be in Europe or in Great Britain. The number here at Media Matters, 217-333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. One of the interesting parts of the book to me, and I think that shows some of your expertise, is you go into hacker culture and talk to hackers and really get into that, and I think you have a very positive assessment of what's called hacker culture. Explain what hacker culture is, what its role is today, and why you're taken by it.
I got into the whole hacker scene because I was following information activists. And a lot of those people are hackers or hacktivists. And they share a lot of the same values as investigative journalists, actually. So there's an interest in freedom of information, in a meritocracy of ideas, so the best idea wins. You don't sort of like step on ideas just because they're because of status or anything like this. And quite anti-authoritarian as well. So it's about challenging authority, and all those things are actually very similar to what journalists do. So I kind of divided up just sort of subjectively hackers into two camps. You've kind of got the sort of vandal hackers, which I feel are the sort of teenage, the stereotypical teenage boys in their mom's bedroom sending out these DDoS attacks to bring down websites. Or you've got the kind of more pro, I would call them more of the creative hackers, who are proactively trying to engage with politics and change politics. And so that would be, organizing letter-writing campaigns to your representative. Or I think the thing we saw around the Stop Online Privacy Act in America, where you had quite a big grassroots movement on the internet to try and change a piece of legislation or, you know, stop a piece of legislation going in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of hacker culture that I like. I find the other part of it, the anonymous, the vandal hackers, I find that group to be more more trouble than help, actually. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I find that they make the case for governments to shut, you know, to control the internet rather than helping any campaigns for transparency or accountability.
You know, one of the, I forget the person who said this, but someone prominent who's in the information industry or internet industry, for lack of a better term, said that where we're really heading very quickly is to a world where you'll have closed, what are walled gardens like Facebook, which gets 15% of all the World Wide Web traffic now into their sort of private walled garden that Google can't get into with their search, and that they control all the data. But also it keeps the viruses out, too, and
yeah,
it keeps the hackers out. I mean, is that where we're going, this antiseptic sort of private preserve where you play by their rules and then they keep the hackers out and you give up all your rights?
Well, and Apple is probably the biggest example of that, where if you want to use an iPhone, you know, if you want to have an app, you have to go through Apple's vetting procedure. And, if, you know, only if you pass their criteria can your app be available.
Are those hacker-free zones? Is the hacker community sort of left then out in the bushes?
I'm sure that there are hackers on there. I'm sure that for a little while there was even a WikiLeaks app, but that got taken down quite quickly. I think, but it's talking about where is mainstream society. And, yeah, I think increasingly, like, the mainstream internet user is going into these walled gardens of Facebook and Apple being predominantly those big walled gardens. And I do think that is dangerous because, you know, maybe at the moment we think of them as a kind of benign force, but the fact is they're not. You know, they have their own interests, and I think the danger is that they start to be seen by their customers as a de facto agent of the state. So, you know, the fact that the American government can start to demand user data from Facebook or Twitter or Google, That does affect their business worldwide, because increasingly global customers will start to think, well, hang on, do I really want to put all my stuff on Facebook? Because basically that's, in a way, that's giving it to the American government. Do I want to do that? And I think that's actually quite counterproductive to American business interests, because, you know, the economy is not great. The one part that's doing very well in America is Silicon Valley, is IT development. And so for the government to come in and kind of the dead hand of government to start interfering in this industry, I don't think generally that's going to be financially beneficial for America in the long term.
Our guest, Heather Brook, author of The Revolution Will Be Digitized. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters and WILL AM 580. We've got about 10 minutes left in the show, and the phone lines remain open if anyone would like to call in. Heather Brook, of course, you've outlined very serious problems and issues, and as you say in the book, the next 10 years may well determine the course of the next century, the sort of path we put the internet on, the key issues before us. And what are the, in your view, the decisive political issues that people should be focusing on, where citizens and internet users can get involved to sort of push the internet in the correct free direction as you see it?
Well, the first, I think there are two main areas of focus. One is around copyright, And there's been several high-profile campaigns in America around either under the guise of copyright or piracy. And so those I'm sure are not going to go away. They'll just keep re-emerging every few months, years.
And let's talk about that for a second before we go to number two, because I think we hear about the term copyright a lot. And what's the problem with copyright? Doesn't that make it possible for artists and creative people and authors like yourself to get compensation?
Well, it can be if it's not abused. But I think the problem is that copyright is increasingly becoming the new polite face of censorship. So when a government doesn't want to come out and just say, we're banning this or we don't want you to do this, or a company wants to keep something off out of the public domain, it doesn't ban it, because that's considered unacceptable now. But what it can do is use intellectual property or copyright law in introducing what it was originally there for. So I mean, like you say, I'm an author, and obviously I don't want it would make it difficult for me to write books in the future if my book was given away for free. And I said earlier, I think people should value knowledge and then value information. And if they think it's worth it, then be happy to pay for it. So there is a sense that we need to have a business case around creative work. But the problem has been that certain creative industries, and I'm thinking mostly about the music and movie industry, have just become so incredibly greedy about it that they're trying to kind of artificially prop up this old business model, which does not work in the digital age. And they are lobbying governments so heavily to artificially keep these keep this old business model going that it's actually stifling new business models from getting off the ground. So if we look at sort of music and films, increasingly people don't want to buy music or films. They want access to it, and they're willing to pay smaller amounts of money to access songs or to watch something. But those business models are finding it very difficult to get off the ground, because we have this industry which increasingly goes around trying to legislate against people being able to share content, even if they've bought it. So, if I buy a book, nobody's going to stop me giving it to the library or lending it to my friends. But if this book was then digitized, we have totally different laws now. So it becomes illegal for me to share it with people or to send it to people or give it to an e-library or something like this. So our laws have not... I think our laws have been sort of manipulated to keep this old system going.
Heather Brooke, we have a couple of callers who've been waiting patiently, and I do want to get to them before we finish this program. Let's start with line four. Paxton, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. Good program. I only heard the first part, so this may be a little off the chart. You mentioned the need for law, the rule of law, yet on the Internet, if there are not some government restrictions, the rule of law is according to each novice that puts his own values and judgments on the job. I find that much on the Internet is coarse and vulgar, but also in doing research for several theses and many papers some time ago, I searched solid sources such as Trilling, Barzun, and Hofstadter and so forth, and now the Internet is replete with self-styled experts, so it is convenient, but it's not always reliable. I don't know how that fits into your thesis there, but thank you.
Thank you very much. Heather Brooke, any comments?
I think as far as sort of the value of information online, I think we all have to become savvy information consumers, because information is a commodity, a very, valuable commodity or a useless commodity, and its value comes in its reliability and its trustworthiness. And so just as we kind of put different values on clothes we see, in the mall or whatever, and we learn ways to judge what is a good quality item, I think we need to go onto the Internet and we need to look at information with the same critical eye. So we obviously, we don't believe everything we see on the Internet. And I think there are a few. I mean, there's just a few skills as a journalist that I think everybody's going to have to be getting to know. So the first, like probably the first one is as a journalist, we're taught how to stand up a story. So if you hear something, a rumor or whatever that might be true, how do you stand that up? And the main way you do it is you try and double source it. You try and get some other person to independently verify that what you heard was true. And I think we're all going to have to learn some of these skills about how to test robustly the trustworthiness of information online.
Let's go to our final caller for the day, Line 1, Bloomington. You're on the air with Heather Brooke.
Yeah, thanks for a great program. I wondered if you could talk a little more about WikiLeaks. I'm not sure I understood everything you were saying. I guess I thought that was the greatest thing because we at last heard things that we suspicioned but didn't really know. So, but I my impression is that, and you said the beginning of WikiLeaks was different too. Okay.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Heather Brooke, WikiLeaks. Maybe from the American perspective, we didn't, unless people were really tuned into the issue closely, the sort of soap opera stuff and the deep in the weeds stuff didn't get here. For a lot of people, it's just all sorts of interesting government material was made available.
Yeah. Well, I think the point was that originally WikiLeaks was very much a kind of cooperative thing. There was a lot of volunteers that worked on it, and it was very much a kind of grassroots type hacktivist organization. And when it was that, I think it was very it was living up to the principles it was preaching, and it did get access to some amazing material. Then it got these what are called mega leaks, and those were mostly the sets, the big giant data sets. There was the Iraq war logs, these Afghan war logs. There was a video called the collateral murder video, and then finally the diplomatic cables, and we should also mention, the person accused of giving all that out to WikiLeaks was Bradley Manning,
mm-hmm.
and he's really paying the price for that information. So, I mean, I even feel it's a bit disingenuous to be talking about WikiLeaks doing that, because WikiLeaks just was a middle. I mean, they were kind of middleman brokering information they'd received from a whistleblower. So, if we're to think that this is an amazing thing that happened, it's really thanks to that whistleblower, and then the journalists who took all that just mountains of data, sifted through it, and made sense of it for the public to understand what does this mean. So I feel like it all got, all these great, there were noble motives behind WikiLeaks. They sort of all got taken hostage by this, the cult of personality that was Julian Assange. And I feel that's really a shame, because there were some great ideas behind WikiLeaks, and I think we need to remember those. And some of the most revolutionary aren't really revolutionary at all. You can find them in the American Constitution and the Bill of Rights.
Is there going to be some version of WikiLeaks continuing that sort of work without Julian Assange, or without sort of a guru head of it, or is this whole enterprise ended?
He's not willing to, take a back seat on it. So, I mean, he may be forced to if he has to go to Sweden. But I think for me, the real thing is to move beyond leaks, because mm-hmm. leaks are really, that they are a symptom of us not getting the information that we need to make. To make informed decisions in a democracy. So the real campaign is to go beyond leaks. It's to have a statutory right to know what our governments do in our name and with our money.
On that note, Heather Brooke, I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means they want to clear me out of the studio. Heather Brooke, author of the new book, The Revolution Will Be Digitized, joining us from London today. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
My great pleasure. And I want to thank Christina Williams, my producer, Kyle Kroha, the engineer, for their great work. As always, I'm Bob McChesney. The next 2 weeks, we're going to have recorded shows with two great scholars. I think you're going to enjoy them a great deal. I'll be back with you live in 3 weeks. Until then, everyone, have a great month of May. Bye-bye.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
Mostly cloudy today in Champaign-Urbana with a very slight chance of showers and isolated thunderstorms this afternoon. The high around 78 degrees. Winds out of the south at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy. Again, a slight chance for showers. The low near 52. Tomorrow, partly sunny. A chance of showers and isolated thunderstorms. The high about 75 degrees. Partly cloudy Sunday night with the low around 50.